May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.
Amen. Amen.
Please be seated. You might have heard the story about the young man in high school who was doing really well in his studies, and then all of a sudden his grades started to slip a little bit. So his teacher called him in and said, "What's going on that your grades are falling off?" And he said, "Well, I asked my dad for a car, and my dad said if I got a job and saved the money, I could have one. So I got a job and I saved the money and bought a car. But then I had to have insurance and I had to have gasoline, I had to have maintenance on the car, so I had to keep working more and more hours at my job, and my grades started to suffer." And the teacher said, "Well, why don't you get rid of the car?" And he said, "Get rid of the car? Then how would I go to work?" Duh. It seems that that's what got him in trouble in the first place, was going to work to get the car. So he'd gotten caught in this vicious cycle that had impacted his life, a cycle that we may be familiar with. Today's parable in Luke, by the way, one of Luke's key themes is possessions and how we use possessions. So we keep returning to this theme a lot in Luke, and I'm hopeful that when our stewardship emphasis comes up, it will make an impact, because we seem to be talking about it a lot. This man was a wealthy religious leader, probably a Pharisee or Sadducee, who thought of himself as someone in right relationship with God. And he was so wealthy that they could have banquets every day. Not on once a week or twice a week, but every day. And if he also was dressing in the most expensive clothes. His underwear was imported from Egypt. That's what fine linen means. His linen undergarments. And they were so consumptive that they had extra loaves of bread on the table because these people ate with their hands, and they would tear bread off an extra loaf and wipe their hands with that to clean their hands and throw the bread under the table for the household dogs. So they were a great example of overconsumption. Eric Fromm, the psychiatrist, once said that we as a species, our name is Homo sapiens, that we should rename ourselves Homo consumens. Well, this man is an overconsumer, and outside the gate, which would make sense if you had a beggar and you wanted to make money, you'd be outside that gate because there's so much traffic every day, was this beggar named Lazarus, who was so debilitated and weak that other people had to carry him and place him there. He couldn't do it himself. And he was so covered in skin sores that the dogs came and licked him. He was so weak, he couldn't drive them away. The working assumption would be that the rich man in Jesus' culture, the working assumption would be that the rich man was close to God. That's why he was prospering so. And the beggar Lazarus was being punished by God for something. That's why he was in such terrible condition. There is a branch of American Christianity that preaches something very similar to that today, that if you're really close to God, you'll prosper. It's called the prosperity gospel. It's just a little bit far from Jesus' teaching, you might say, maybe more than a little bit. And the difficulty with this story is that everything is backwards from the way people think it is. And that should send us a real warning today. The things can be backwards from the way we think they are. This is the only parable Jesus tells where somebody gets named. And the name is Lazarus, which in Jesus' language means God is my help. And we learn when they die that the beggar actually is close to God, because he's carried to the place of honor in the heavenly banquet. He couldn't get in the door down here at the banquet, but he gets the place of honor up there. And the rich man who had the place of honor and his own home ends up downstairs, if you will. Now please don't assume from this story that we're getting something about the geography of heaven and hell here, because we're really not. Jesus is using some popular imagery, not for the final state of the dead in hell and the final state of the saved in heaven, but he's using a popular Jewish image for that place where everybody sort of goes and waits for the resurrection. So it's not to be assumed that Jesus is teaching that hell is a literal fire and that people can see each other across the chasm. But I don't think Jesus would have told this story if he didn't believe that people without faith are greatly at risk, do you? So, what does this say to us? And I have been struggling with how to talk about this, and I'm aware of my limited time. But I have to tell a story on myself. My first church out of seminary was First Baptist Church, Williamsburg, Kentucky, in Whitley County. My kids were born in Corbin, Kentucky, and I developed a deep love for Kentucky while I was living there. We had a church member named John Watts, an elderly man who was slightly mentally impaired, who was one of the town tricksters. He was very poor, but he knew how to get what he needed by tricksterism. I spent 5 years dealing with John as the senior pastor at First Baptist Church. He would come to church on Sunday dressed in the only suit of clothes he had, poorly shaven and poorly bathed. And you know, the Baptist church, you give an altar call, right, at the end for people to come down and join. John would come down and ask for a ride home. And after the service, I would say, now, John, Mr. Crisp is going to take you home. You don't have to come and ask for a ride. But if 3 or 4 weeks later, he'd forget that, and down the alley would come again to ask for a ride home. After about 3 years, he figured he'd worn out his welcome at our church. He went up and joined Main Street Baptist. And the next day, the pastor called me and said, what did I do to you? Then after about a year, he came back and joined our church again. Well, this went on for the years I was there. I had resigned the church to go to New Orleans Seminary to teach, and I had about 3 months where I was still serving. And about 2 weeks before I was to leave, I had to drive from Williamsburg to Louisville for a church-related meeting. It was raining like crazy that night, and I wasn't going to be able to get away until about 7 o'clock. My phone rang. It was John's daughter, Alice. David, Daddy's in the hospital in Pineville. Well, if you know your geography, that's 90 miles east of Williamsburg, or an hour and a half, about 60 miles, in a driving rain, and I had to go 180 miles this way that night. And I thought, you know, I'm not going. I'm leaving in 2 weeks. Nobody cares about John. And then it hit me. If it was the president of Cumberland University, you'd go. So I did. I drove that 9 hour and a half in that driving rain and got there around 9 or 9:30. Had to go around back of the Appalachian Regional Commission Hospital through the ER up to his room. He was in a ward with 7 other beds. Footlights were on. He looked up, saw me, jumped up, ran down the center of the ward, pulled me down and hugged my neck and rubbed that beard into my face. And he turned around and put his shoulder over my hand over my shoulder and said and yelled out, because he was hard of hearing, "Hey, everybody, this is my preacher." I had never felt like John's brother in 5 years. But that night I realized, this is my brother. And what this text is telling us, that our wealth and our possessions and our misguided ways of looking at other people are separating us from people that we should be connecting to spiritually. And this parable is a huge warning to us about the skewed vision we have and the way that our style of life separates us from people who are connected to God and in whom Christ lives that we are ignoring. Money is a tricky thing. It's not morally neutral. Up above this text, there's a paragraph where Jesus says, you cannot serve two masters. You will love the one and hate the other, be joined to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and possessions. In other words, money in the biblical understanding is not morally neutral. It is demonic. It can corrupt our vision, elicit our loyalty, and separate us from those we love and skew our life values. And our whole journey can be captive to possessions. And we can be deluded into thinking that because we have a lot, our life is full. Thomas More once wrote in his book, The Care of the Soul, money is so numinous, so full of mystery and fantasy and emotion and resistant to rational guidance that although it has much to offer, it can easily swamp the soul and carry consciousness off into compulsion and obsession. You might remember the lyrics to Sheryl Crow's song, Soak Up the Sun. One line she says, I don't sings, I don't have digital, I don't have diddly squat, it's not having what you want, it's wanting what you've got. So I think today this story stands us on tiptoe and says to us we need to take a look at our lives and what a grip our possessions have on us and how they are separating us from people that we need to be connected with in the world, that some of our time needs to be bracketed out from earning and possessing to giving, and perhaps we occasionally need to take something that's very precious to us and give it away just to declare our independence of the things we own that, and in fact, often own us. Amen.